Thanks for listening to Press Play. If you're like me and you need help navigating the busy film award season, I have a podcast just for you. It's called The Treatment, and it's hosted by Elvis Mitchell. And Elvis really goes beyond the simple plot outline to understand what inspires the people who make these movies, the actors, the filmmakers, the producers. So check it out, The Treatment, on KCRW's iTunes page.
Oh, I fixed your keyboard.
You what?
Yeah. I took all the letters off and I put them back in alphabetical order.
Why?
They were mixed up.
Well, they're supposed to be mixed up, Monk. Every keyboard is like that.
I know. It's always bothered me.
Ah, TV's Monk, the lovable detective with obsessive compulsive disorder. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Madeline Brand. Monk often played OCD for laughs, but coming up, we'll hear from the author of a new book on OCD about his own very serious struggle with the debilitating condition. First, a different kind of health story. In last night's State of the Union speech, President Obama called for legislation expanding sick and family leave for workers. Well, here in California, we already have those things, at least some of us do. But what are the chances of national legislation, and what's holding us back from it? Janet Gornick is a professor of political science and sociology at the Graduate Center, City University of New York. Hi, Janet.
Hi. Nice to be here.
It's wonderful to have you here. But before we get talking, let's hear what the president said last night on this.
Today, we are the only advanced country on Earth that doesn't guarantee paid sick leave or paid maternity leave to our workers. 43 million workers have no paid sick leave. 43 million. Think about that. And that forces too many parents to make the gut-wrenching choice between a paycheck and a sick kid at home. So I'll be taking new action to help states adopt paid leave laws of their own. And since paid sick leave won where it was on the ballot last November, let's put it to a vote right here in Washington. Send me a bill that gives every worker in America the opportunity to earn 7 days of paid sick leave. That's the right thing to do.
Okay, paid sick leave, also family leave on the agenda. Let's take them one at a time. First, the president here urging lawmakers to guarantee workers paid sick days. Now, we have a law like that here in California. It just passed last year, and it requires companies to grant workers 3 paid sick days a year. And that really doesn't sound like much of a victory. Can you put it in context for us?
Well, that's true. It's a victory. I guess it's a foot in the door. It certainly is a very meager entitlement. As the president hinted, and as you and I'm sure many of your listeners know, paid sick leave, meaning both the right to take some days off when sick or when a child is sick, a family member is sick, with some wages as well, is standard in nearly all of the rich countries in the world. And it's begun, of course, to be discussed seriously in the United States. For the most part, we've seen it passed at the local level, as I think you know, in California, as it did with paid family leave years ago, has been a leader now in enacting a statewide sick bill. 3 days is really very little. The bill that President Obama is talking about in Washington is 7 days, which I think by international standards is pretty much the minimum that we would hope for. Nevertheless, if the bill is passed, it has been passed in California, as I understand it, will come in this summer, it could be extended. So I certainly applaud, the introduction of the whole idea there.
Well, what's standing in the way of making paid sick leave more widespread, and how many of the objections are purely financial?
Well, that's a really good question. I have to say, it's the question that's always being asked in this country: is why are we such a laggard, such an international laggard, when it comes to policies that help people combine essentially work and family. Just to back up to say, as I'm sure you know, in the United States we have a much smaller social welfare system than most other rich countries, and people explain that with a whole variety of explanations, including, you know, we tend to prefer the market to government, we don't like intrusions of the state into our families and so forth. But that's really not enough, because we have many social programs in this country that don't look that different from other countries: Social Security, disability, veterans benefits. But when it comes to benefits for working families, something is different here. We're really exceptionally exceptional. So some of it, I think, is the old standard dislike of government programs. But some of it, I think, is a sort of an odd obsession in the United States about paid work, that being employed for long hours, being present at work, those are viewed as sort of innately valuable, and we tend to shy away from anything that relaxes people's obligation to be at work. And in addition, a sense that raising your children and taking care of your family is a private matter. It's between you and your family. That's a kind of uniquely American framing. I think I also note often that the mommy wars are still being fought here where they've been settled in other places. So it's kind of a perfect storm of factors that have led to this really almost mysterious resistance to put in place some of the most simple and straightforward measures that actually would enable people to work more stably and with, you know, with many fewer problems.
Well, it really is an interesting combination, a tangle of cultural biases. And we also see it with family leave. We guarantee family leave here in California. We've had it much longer than our sick leave law. But all the studies show that people, when they are offered it, when they qualify for it, very few people actually take advantage of the benefit.
Yeah. So just to go back to sick leave for just a second, I do think that a corner is turning here. There's been a lot of talk recently. We used to hear a lot about absenteeism, and maybe this is mostly still in the academic and policy world, but we're hearing a lot more about presenteeism now, meaning this phenomenon of people being at work when they're sick, you know, making themselves sick, making each other sick. And the concerns about productivity, I think, I'm hearing in more and more locations, including in HR and various places, that there seems to be more and more agreement that we don't want people at work when they're sick. And now back to family leave, a very similar story, I would say. A same set of barriers have kept us from providing in the United States the same kinds of benefits that are provided in virtually every country in the world. Every country in the world nearly has maternity leave, and every rich country has parental leave. So it's been very odd that we can't get this to stick. And I would say about California, frankly, I followed the law there very closely over many years from when it was passed and through the last evaluations. It is also a very meager law, I'm afraid. You know, the benefit level is low, the duration is short. By international standards, it's very meager, but we keep our eye on it. Now, why is it not being used more? I think people are afraid of being punished by their employers because it's still not universally accepted.
Well, given that California's a super blue state, clearly,
right,
and it took a decade of pushing to push it through, what can
right.
we expect on the federal level?
Well, let me answer that. I just want to say one more thing about California, if I could. I'm sure you probably know there was recently a book written about the California program called Unfinished Business by Ruth Milkman and Eileen Applebaum. It's a wonderful review of the first decade of paid leave in California. And I think the most remarkable finding, though, has been a disappointing finding, which is that the use of it has been very regressive, meaning the kinds of people who would have had employer-based benefits are the people who are using it in California. And a lot of that has to do with a very uneven spread of knowledge. Low-wage, low-skilled workers with employers that don't provide benefits privately are exactly the workers who had low levels of knowledge about the new California law. So that tells me that remedy is fairly straightforward, really aggressive public education. Now, back to the federal level, we do all have our eyes on California, so I hope it will still be an inspiration. We absolutely need it at the federal level, and I would say there were two things about I was thrilled, of course, to hear President Obama say anything, but I, like many, was very disappointed to hear him use the term maternity leave instead of parental for all the obvious reasons.
Placing it in a female ghetto.
Absolutely. And, I mean, what we really need, of course, is parental leave or family leave. These terms vary, but an umbrella term that would include maternity and paternity leave, short-term leave, you know, when around the time of birth, but also parental leave, which in many countries can be taken in various ways up, you know, for 3 years or
right.
8 years.
And we could talk about this for the rest of the hour. I want to thank you
right.
so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Janet Gornick is a professor of political science and sociology at the Graduate Center, City University of New York. And thanks again. And what do you all think? Should everyone have access to paid sick leave and paid family leave? Give us a call, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page. Well, getting paid sick leave is important, but getting well again is important, too. Last night in a State of the Union, the president talked about something called personalized medicine. Here's what he said.
I want the country that eliminated polio and mapped the human genome to lead a new era of medicine, one that delivers the right treatment at the right time. In some patients with cystic fibrosis, this approach has reversed a disease once thought unstoppable. So tonight I'm launching a new precision medicine initiative to bring us closer to curing diseases like cancer and diabetes, and to give all of us access to the personalized information we need to keep ourselves and our families healthier.
And here to explain what the president is talking about is Dr. Jason Vasey. He's a primary care physician and genomic medicine researcher at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Barbara.
What do doctors and researchers mean when they use this phrase personalized medicine? It seems a bit squishy.
Yeah, and sometimes we actually don't know ourselves what we mean when we use it. There's actually some discussion about what exactly it means. Now, last night, I think President Obama was referring to using a patient's genetic makeup or the molecular changes that you can observe for a certain patient's disease to help guide the therapy that is going to be best for that person.
And that referred to the cystic fibrosis example.
That was the one example he gave, and we've got others in medicine too. But that's what I think when President Obama is using the term precision medicine, he means.
Well, it's interesting because with that example, the personalized medical treatment only works for about 4% of people with cystic fibrosis, I understand. And it's already a pretty rare disease, so that's a really small group. And developing these drugs is so expensive. So does this mean that personalized medicine will be available mostly for the wealthy, or what are we talking about here?
No, first we have to realize this technology is so new right now. Yes, the human genome was sequenced more than a decade ago, but we still have a considerable amount of time left ahead of us to figure out how this is actually going to improve patient care. So because the technology to this point has been so expensive for us to do genomic sequencing, for us to do other types of molecular diagnostic tests, we don't have the widespread experience with this kind of testing to see on large populations of patients how it's going to improve, if it does, their care that we can deliver. So now that the technology is starting to become more affordable, more cost-effective and time-effective, we can start to get greater and greater experience with this technology and start to identify the patients for whom it will and will not improve outcomes.
And how are drug companies moving forward with this technology?
Well, a lot of drug companies do realize that their new ready-for-market treatments are only going to work in patients who have these certain changes, either at the genetic or the molecular level. And so often there's a lot of debate right now about packaging both the diagnostic test and the drug to go along with it as kind of one product. And that's an active area of debate right now in the biomedical community. Fortunately, one of the barriers to precision medicine, the cost of the test in the first place, is starting to come down.
Well, the cost of
the therapeutics, though, on the other hand, isn't quite there yet.
In terms of talking about looking at people's genomes and finding flaws before they get sick, the preventive side of this, and the famous example, of course, is Angelina Jolie getting a double mastectomy, not because she had breast cancer, but because she was at risk for it because she carried the BRCA1 gene. It seems as if the great hurdle is assessment and analysis of what exactly risk means for an individual.
That's exactly right, and I'm so glad you raised this point, because I think there's a misperception in the community that this is a given, that the geneticists, the physicians, can look at your genetic code and know what your life holds before you. Will you get this disease or not? When will you succumb to it? There is so much uncertainty, even though the human genome has been sequenced. We are still just now at the tip of the iceberg starting to decipher what that sequence means for human health.
And how do you see the future of this kind of medicine playing out, or what is your hope for it, for its role in healthcare in the near future?
Well, my hope as a physician is always that new technology will improve the way we deliver care to our patients and the kind of outcomes they have, that they will live longer and those longer years will be filled with quality of life. That's always the goal with any new technology or drug that we have. How that's going to play out in the near term will remain to be seen. We need a lot more experience with genomic testing on large groups of patients to know what exactly it means, which genetic changes do we need to be worried about, and which ones are just changes that actually don't have consequence for human health.
And in terms of the president's proposal, he hasn't made public what he plans for this precision medicine initiative. But what are your thoughts on how the president and the federal government might help move things forward? And is this an area of medicine that desperately needs regulation?
Well, I think it regulation would come, I think, after we have some more evidence. In terms of policy, I'll leave that to the policymakers. There's no question that this is an exciting field of science that is growing by leaps and bounds every day. And I'm glad that last night the president was able to bring this to the nation's attention because, frankly, it is something that our country can be proud of because we really are leaders in genomic science.
But getting specific, does it have to do with getting drugs approved more quickly or insurance to pay for testing and treatment or regulation of the many tests that will be coming onto the market?
There's no question that there are certain parts of our regulatory pipeline that can seem slow and inefficient and frustrating, especially to patients and physicians who want to benefit from that. There's always the balance of risks and benefits, though, about bringing an untested product to market and to patient care without yet knowing the full risks and benefits. And that's an important balance to find that can seem frustrating from both sides of the fence.
Dr. Jason Vassy is a primary care physician and genomic medicine researcher at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and at the VA Boston Healthcare System. I appreciate it. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks so much, Barbara.
Just ahead, when your mind is your worst enemy, we meet David Adam, the author of The Man Who Couldn't Stop, OCD and the True Story of a Life Lost in Thought. And that's after a news update with Eric Roy.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Barbara Bogavin for Madeline Brand. The deadline set by ISIS is approaching. The group says it will kill two Japanese captives if Japan doesn't pay a $200 million ransom by Friday. ISIS released a video of the two hostages kneeling down in orange jumpsuits with a masked militant waving a knife around them, demanding the money. The eerie images are similar to other videos released by the group, and those threats led to the executions of four Western hostages last year. Roland Kelch joins us now to discuss the way the Japanese public and government are reacting to the situation. Roland is a contributing writer for The New Yorker and The Japan Times, and it's good to have you on our show.
Thank you, Barbara.
So the Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, says he won't negotiate with terrorists. So what other avenues are open to him, and what's known about exactly what the government is doing right now?
Well, there aren't many avenues open to Prime Minister Abe, in part because Japan still has a pacifist constitution that prohibits them from having a standing army. So Abe certainly cannot pay the ransom. As an ally of the United States, on the one hand, he's hamstrung, but also it's likely the Japanese public wouldn't stand for that. They are negotiating through various avenues with their Middle Eastern friends. Japan has quite a number of friends in the Middle East, and I think in particular they're talking with the Jordanian government. But beyond that, he doesn't have many avenues, and in particular because of the deadline. I think it's the first time ISIS has issued a specific deadline.
And that deadline is?
That will be Thursday night around 9:50 p.m. California time.
Now, some say the video might be a fake. Who is saying that, and what evidence are they citing?
In Japan, that video has been shown over and over again, and it's being analyzed and tested. And the first thing that was pointed out was that the shadows of the two captives, they fall in different directions. So the suspicion is that these guys may have been filmed separately and may have been filmed at different times, and then one or the other was inserted into the video. In fact, the ISIS spokesman and one of the hostages, their shadows fall in the same direction, but the second hostage, his shadow falls in a different direction.
Well, if the video is doctored, what are the implications of that?
Well, I suppose there could be several. I mean, I think that what I'm getting from Japanese media is that, you know, one question is, are these guys still alive? When was the video shot? Is this authentic? I think it's not a question of identifying the two hostages, but it's a question of trying to ascertain when the video was made, whether it was made with the two men together. If it wasn't, has one of them already been killed? Questions also of location. I think what has triggered all this is the positioning of the shadows, which even to the untrained eye, it seems out of whack.
And what do we know about these two Japanese captives?
Well, they emerge from quite different scenarios. Haruna Yukawa, the younger one, he's sort of a self-styled soldier of fortune. He had a string of bad luck in Tokyo. His wife died of lung cancer, he lost his job, and then he lost his home. And he sort of left for the Middle East in early last year to allegedly learn about military conflict, and he said to educate himself to help Japanese troops in the future. He has said on the one hand he was supplying medical equipment, and then at other times he said he had a military contracting company. But none of those things are really verified. The other guy is older, 47 years old. He's a very well-respected journalist. His name is Kenji Goto, and he has been reporting from war zones since the 1990s. He's done reports for some of Japan's major TV networks. And he had met and befriended Yukawa last year. And then when Yukawa disappeared in August, Mr. Goto said he was determined to go back and find him. And he went back in October, late October, and that's when he disappeared.
Given their backstories, how sympathetic is the Japanese public to the hostages? And some reports say that the journalist went into Syria knowing how dangerous the situation was.
Not only knowing how dangerous it is, but he actually made a video that was shot by his Syrian guide just before he left for Raqqa, which is the city where they believe these guys are being held, and a city that is controlled by the Islamic State extremist group. He made a video saying he was taking full responsibility for what he was doing. He knew it was dangerous. And if an incident were to occur, the Syrian people should not be blamed. He takes full responsibility for it. You know, this refers back to an incident in 2004 where three Japanese hostages were released from Iraq. And when they returned home, they were greeted with harsh criticism from the Japanese public and media. In fact, so harsh that they went through a second trauma upon returning home, which many said was worse than the initial abduction. They were essentially shamed because they had acted with such hubris. By the terms of Japanese culture, they had gone off on their own, knowing it was a dangerous situation, putting themselves at risk, even though they were providing humanitarian aid. So that precedent, I would suspect, is partly behind Goto's desire to convey to the Japanese public that he knows what he's doing and he takes responsibility for it. I suspect the sympathies that the Japanese public feel are even less strong for Yukawa, the other guy, Haruna Yukawa, because he seemed to have gone off the rails. You know, he wasn't really professionally working over in Syria, didn't have a history as a reporter. He was over there seemingly doing some random things because he had lost control of things at home.
Well, given these cultural pressures and the fact that the Japanese prime minister has been pushing his country to be more hawkish in global affairs recently, which is not something that the Japanese public is often comfortable with, how could this situation affect his agenda moving forward?
Well, I think it could go either way. If these hostages, if they haven't been murdered already, and if they are murdered in the barbaric fashion that we've seen in the past, it could, on the one hand, anger the Japanese public. It would be something they haven't seen in a while. And that could inspire at least some of the Japanese citizenry to seek greater military power and strength and to have more capacity for Japan to defend itself in these situations. Japan, as I said before, they really can't go in with any kind of rescue mission because they don't have a standing army. On the other hand, if something barbaric happens to these men, it may strengthen the yearning of many Japanese to stick with its pacifist constitution and to stay out of international affairs, to isolate itself even more, and may cause Abe's relatively hawkish stance to diminish.
Roland Keltz. He's a contributing writer for The New Yorker and The Japan Times. He's also the author of Japan, America, How Japanese Pop Culture Has Invaded the U.S. Thanks a lot for bringing us up to date on this story. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Barbara.
Just ahead, the true story of a life lost in thought. David Adam joins us. His new book is about obsessive compulsive disorder. That's after this news update.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogavin for Madeline Brand. The young lady was 18 years old when it happened. She was walking home from her aunt's house when a thought wormed its way into her head. What if she had stolen something from her aunt before leaving? Well, of course she hadn't. But what if? She was a very honest person, and she hated the idea of stealing. But she just couldn't stop thinking, I might have done it. And this one thought kicked off an all-consuming obsession that included wearing shoes so tight that her flesh bulged over the tops of them, all in an attempt to prevent herself from slipping coins into her shoes. Known as Mademoiselle F, she was the first documented case of obsessive-compulsive disorder, or OCD. Now, this was in the early 19th century, but now 2 to 3% of the world population suffer from OCD. David Adam, for one. He has a new book about the disorder called The Man Who Couldn't Stop, OCD and the True Story of a Life Lost in Thought. Madeline spoke with David Adam yesterday.
David Adam joins me now. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you.
Well, before we get to your story, your personal story, I just want to find out from you about what OCD is. I mean, there's this fundamental misunderstanding, I think that people who have perfectionist tendencies, they keep their desks super tidy, they alphabetize their books, they're clean freaks, you know, they say they're a little bit OCD, or, you know, people think of Jack Nicholson in As Good As It Gets and they laugh at him, you know, not stepping on the cracks or whatever. But that's not really what OCD is at all from the description in your book. It's quite a serious illness.
The biggest clue to Jack Nicholson not really having OCD is that as he is walking down the street trying not to step on the cracks, he has this big grin on his face, you know, and he's actually skipping at one point. It looks like he's enjoying it. I think some people have a bit of O and some people have a bit of C, but the D is what really gets people who have OCD, and it stands for disorder, but it could equally stand for disruption or devastation. It's when obsessive thoughts and the compulsive behaviours, almost always as a response to those thoughts, become so overbearing that they overtake your life. So some people with OCD might have a compulsion of cleaning, but they don't enjoy cleaning and they're certainly not proud of it, and it's not something that anybody should aspire to have. I think some people use OCD as a shorthand for a positive trait. You know, oh, it's great, I'm so tidy. Mm. And that is a misconception.
And so when you say it's a disorder, you say that the thoughts are intrusive about how much of the day is devoted to these thoughts, do you think, on average?
Oh, well, my day was all those thoughts for years. It sounds unbelievable, and I'm thankfully a bit better now, and even I find it hard to believe, but you just have a thought which is in your head 24/7. It's the first thing you think about when you wake up. It's the last thing you think about before you go to bed. It really is ever present.
And the thought, as you're experiencing it, you realize that it is absurd and illogical and irrational, and yet you can't stop
yourself. Yeah, exactly. So the actual thoughts themselves are quite common. Most people have them. They're the kind of thoughts that just make people go, whoa, what's that about? So a really common one is when you're driving your car, so people get an urge to, what would happen if I was just to steer off the road? or when you're waiting for the train to come, or you're stood on a high place like a bridge, people might get an urge to jump in front of the train or to jump off this high place. And in most people, those thoughts come and go. But in some people, and this is what I try and explore in the book, because of the psychology, those thoughts, they get stuck. And then as a way to make those thoughts go away, people develop these sometimes bizarre compulsive rituals, which do seem to make them go away, but only in the short term. And then they come back, and then you have to perform the ritual again. And so you very quickly get locked into this cycle, and it's the scale of that cycle which dominates, which causes the disorder, the disruption.
Well, since you brought it up, let's talk about your story. You had this obsessive fear that you would get AIDS, and you couldn't stop thinking about it.
Yeah, so I grew up in the 80s. We didn't know much about HIV at the time. So the sort of the health policy was just to scare everyone witless. So we had all these dreadful adverts on the television. It stuck with me, and it wasn't just me. It was a really common obsession of the time in the late 80s. Something like a third of OCD patients in the US incorporated HIV. And the ways in which I believed or worried that I could contract HIV were all the ways that you are told that you couldn't. So I knew that there was no risk, and yet I couldn't stop feeling anxious about it. So, for example, if I cut my finger on a piece of glass, I would think, well, maybe there was blood on the glass. Maybe someone else had cut themselves on the glass. Maybe that blood has now got into me. Maybe they'd had HIV. And although I knew it was ridiculous, there is just that tiny, tiny, tiny sliver of a chance that maybe that did happen. And so that's why my compulsion was to try and convince myself that it hadn't happened, that there was no risk, whereas most people would be content with the reassurance that it was a very, 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 very low risk. But in my OCD, and I think in many people's OCD, we don't accept that. We want the risk to be zero.
Ironic that you are a science reporter, so you really do know that the risk is minimal.
Yeah, you know, I once interviewed a scientist called Luc Montagnier, who was a virologist who won a Nobel Prize for discovering the HIV virus. So I know my way around risk and hazard and science and viruses, but it's completely irrational. You cannot argue your way out of it. It is just something deep inside. We know that we shouldn't be thinking this. We don't need anybody else to tell us that. We know it, but knowing it doesn't make it go away, unfortunately.
And then the compulsion part of it, I guess it's part of a vicious circle, because the compulsion you have to undertake to get rid of the thought kind of makes you more obsessive about the thought.
I think, yeah, it does. It is. It's the other side of the cycle. So in my case, I was seeking reassurance. And in doing that, I almost validated the original fear, because if I was responding to it, then it must have been real. And so very quickly you get this chicken and egg situation where what comes first? Is it the fear or the behavior which you do which reinforces the fear? But some people have compulsive behaviors which they don't seem to answer or in any way rationally resolve the thought. So, for example, someone who has this thought about stepping in front of a train might find that if they just tap their feet three times or four times or six times, then the thought goes away. And you know, there's no way tapping your feet would physically stop you jumping in front of a train, but it seems to help the thought go away, and so people do it. And then they start to think, well, the reason I didn't jump was because I stepped in that way, so I'm going to keep doing it just in case. And once again, you get locked into this cycle.
Also, something I found fascinating in your book is, as you say, that scientists now link 20 different conditions to OCD, including anorexia, Tourette syndrome, even schizophrenia, PTSD, maybe autism as well?
Well, yes. So mental disorders are notoriously difficult to diagnose, because there's no test. You can't do a blood test, or you can't do take someone's pulse or any of these ways that you would diagnose a physical illness. And so it depends on how you want to link them. And there is a movement which is trying to link mental conditions through either obsessive thoughts or compulsive behaviours. And if you draw it like that, then yeah, anorexia is very often dominated by very strange thoughts about food and about a self-image. I mean, hypochondria, people will have heard of, that's always around exaggerating health fears or symptoms. And then there's things like hoarding disorder, where people just can't throw stuff away, which seems to be driven by a compulsive need to hang on to stuff. Then there are compulsive things like compulsive skin picking and compulsive hair pulling, which some people relate to them as well. So yeah, the idea is that OCD for a long time was thought of as an anxiety disorder, and there's certainly anxiety as a component, but there is a suggestion now that actually there's a lot more to it.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with David Adam. His new book is called The Man Who Couldn't Stop: OCD and the True Story of a Life Lost in Thought. Well, you said that you suffered for some 20 years with your disorder. How did you finally get a handle on it?
I finally went for help, which is a lot harder than it sounds. In fact, it takes about 10 years typically for people with OCD to go and get proper help. I was lucky. I got a treatment which is it's a combination of antidepressant drugs and cognitive behavioural therapy, which it doesn't make it go away completely, but it does give you tools to help handle it. So I describe it as a bit like being a recovering alcoholic. You know, you're always a recovering OCD-er because the thoughts still come. I still have anxieties about HIV every single day, but what I try very hard to do is not to perform those compulsive checks. And touch wood, although that isn't it's not an OCD touching wood. today's been okay, and that's how I measure it. You know, I have good and I have bad days now, and I used to have just bad days, so that's a lot better.
Well, when you're talking about the CBT, the therapy aspect of it, what exactly did you have to do in your therapy?
So the cognitive bit is learning about the kind of psychology that we just talked about. So how you can interpret thoughts and how to change that. The B is the behavioural, which can get a bit more tricky. And so the idea is that you expose people to whatever it is that's making them anxious, but then so you stimulate the obsession, but you stop them performing the compulsive behaviour that reassures them. So this actually happened when I was in therapy. I had a thought that I might have just rubbed blood into my eyes because I was tired and I'd rubbed my eyes and I thought there might be blood on the seat. And so I said to the therapist, look, I'm having this thought right now. What should I do? And he said, stand up, look at me, put your arms out to the side, and now rub your eyes again. And I couldn't do it because part of me thought there's blood on my hands and I'm just going to make the situation worse. And so he said, OK, if you're not going to rub your hands again, sorry, if you're not going to rub your eyes again, you can't look at your hands. Because all I wanted to do was check there was no blood on my hands until the anxiety goes away. And so I did, and it took 3 days, during which time I'd bathed my baby, I'd had a shower. By any rational explanation, any blood that even was there would have been washed away, but still I had this overwhelming urge to check, and I didn't. And in time, because it has to, the anxiety goes down, and then the theory is that once you experience that, you're more confident that it will go down in future without performing the compulsions, and so you are less likely to do them, and that's one way of breaking that cycle.
Well, that's so interesting because what you're describing is a really rational response or a treatment protocol, I guess, to trying to cure these irrational thoughts. And it seems counterintuitive in a sense that they would go away because they are irrational to begin with.
The thoughts don't go away. You don't have any control over your thoughts. If I was to say to you now, don't think of an elephant, really try hard not to think of an elephant, then you know what happens. But what we do have control over is our behaviour, which is how the compulsions begin in the first place. And so it's not necessarily about making the thoughts go away, but it's about stopping me responding to them.
So every day you have the thoughts?
Oh, yeah, all the time. All the time. But I do have this faith now that if I see it out, if I just live with the anxiety, then when I wake up the next morning, it won't be there. And that is such a relief.
Well, I want to thank you so much for speaking to me about this. It's fascinating.
No, thank you.
David Adam, he's a writer and editor at the scientific journal Nature. His new book is called The Man Who Couldn't Stop, OCD, and the True Story of a Life Lost in Thought.
Switching gears, as we always do at this time, Warren Olney is here. What's on the show, Warren?
Well, we're going to have a very lively show today. We're going to start in Havana, where the highest delegation since the Jimmy Carter years has arrived to negotiate and hear how difficult the negotiations are going to be. And one of the very interesting things about it, I think, that we have brought forth is that the Americans seem more optimistic about making progress in various ways than the Cubans do. Which is an interesting point of view. Yeah, mm-hmm. Then we're also going to talk with Sarah Chase, the former NPR correspondent who now has a book. She was in Afghanistan and Algeria, and a remarkable woman, has a book about how corruption can be what leads to violent extremism. Corruption in government is not necessarily religion. And we'll have a wonderful conversation, very lively conversation about the State of the Union speech.
Well, packing the show in as always.
Thank you
so much. And coming up on this show, the Nazis stole hundreds of thousands of pieces of art. And 70 years later, one family is possibly a small step closer to getting some of their work back. Their case could affect similar cases throughout the country. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogaven for Madeline Brand. As the Nazis rolled through Europe, they plundered art from museums, galleries, and private collections. 70 years later, the owners of some 100,000 of those stolen pieces of art are still trying to get them back. Well, now one family has gotten a small step closer to recovering a work they say is rightfully theirs. Yesterday, the Supreme Court refused to hear a case involving the Norton Simon Museum in Pasadena and Renaissance-era portraits of Adam and Eve that they claim to hold title to. The court's action, or perhaps we should say inaction, may not only help end the long journey these works have taken over the years, it could also have a ripple effect on some similar cases pending throughout the country. Mike Mohm is an arts writer for the Los Angeles Times, and he's been covering this story. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Barbara. Thanks for the inviting me on.
So could you tell us about these paintings in question so that we can picture them while we talk about the less beautiful business of lawsuits?
There are two separate paintings paired. It's the term of art is called a diptych by Lucas Cranach the Elder, who is a German painter of the 1500s. They were painted, Adam and Eve were painted at about 1530. And these are not religious paintings. The Eve portion was your basic version of erotica circa 1530. But both of them are nude, strategically covered by a little, I don't know if it's a fig leaf, it's some kind of a leaf. Both are seen holding the apple in the moment of their temptation. Adam is looking extremely troubled with a kind of, what have I gotten into look on his face.
Right. This is a wonderful start. Now, how did the Norton Simon end up with them?
Well, Norton Simon, who was an industrial magnate who founded the museum, bought them in 1971 from a man who was the heir of Russian nobles, the Stroganov family, who claimed that his family owned them until the 1920s when they were seized by the Soviet Union.
And here's where it gets very thorny, because Mireille von Sayer says that they belong to her family, that the Stroganov family has no right to them. So what claim does Sayer have on the diptych?
Well, in 1932, the Soviets put these paintings, became part of an auction of Soviet-owned art. And Mireille von Sayer's father-in-law, a leading art dealer from Amsterdam, bought them at the auction. So And he owned them. His name was Jacques Hoetsticker. He owned them until 1940 when he, being Jewish, fled with his family when the Nazis invaded Holland, leaving his art gallery and his collection behind. And they were seized by the Nazis and taken over by Hermann Göring, who was one of the top officials in Adolf Hitler's regime. In 1945, the Third Reich fell. American forces uncovered Göring's stash of art and, in keeping with U.S. policy, sent the paintings back to Holland and left it to the Dutch government to decide who the rightful owners were.
And that's interesting that the Sayhir family didn't petition for the right to recover these paintings then. Why didn't they?
Well, Hoetsticker himself had died on the ship on which he was fleeing to America. After the war, his widow, Desi, got in contact with the Dutch government and made various claims. But for this painting and hundreds of others, she did not submit a formal claim. It boils down to her feeling that the way the Dutch were handling claims by Holocaust victims was not a level playing field, that she wouldn't get a fair hearing or a fair result. So she did not formally enter a claim, I guess, as a way of just protesting how things were being handled.
Okay, now getting to these lawsuits, they've been going on since 2007, and we haven't even gotten to the actual court case where they look at the evidence of ownership, who this painting really does belong to. So what has been argued so far in court?
Well, for 8 years, going on 8 years, the argument has been, does Ms. von Sayhir have a right to sue for these paintings? Does she have a right to have her case heard? And there are various legal doctrines that have been examined and reviewed and litigated, and whether she has the right to sue still remains in question, although she's managed to clear a couple of hurdles, but there are probably more preliminary issues that remain to be decided before the whole history of the paintings can be explored through summoning expert witnesses and evidence, documents, whatever, pertaining to their ownership history.
And you're referring to the Washington Principles of 1998 and the Terezin Declaration of 2007? Why aren't these doctrines enough to solve the problem of looted art? Do they contradict each other?
One novel thing that has resulted from this case is this decision saying that in the Ninth Circuit, which is the Western United States, these principles, which basically say that valid claims for Nazi looted art shouldn't be balked by procedural kinds of questions if the claim is valid. And of course, in this case, the Norton Simon Museum is arguing vehemently that the claim is not valid, that the chain of ownership was broken after World War II, and that they have legitimate title, that Norton Simon's purchase was completely legitimate, and that's what's being argued still.
Now, I said earlier that this Supreme Court's refusal to hear the von Sayhir case might affect other cases that are similar to this. How so?
Well, that's where that the Ninth Circuit's opinion invokes the Washington Principles and the Terezin Declaration and says that they violated the U.S. policy after the war that said foreign governments should be entrusted to decide who the owners are.
You know, it's interesting in talking about this case, I feel very torn. On the one hand, I love museums. On the other, it seems somehow not quite right that museums would contest the right of individuals to these works of art.
Well, I can only tell you what the Norton Simon Museum's position is. They say that the law entitles them to keep these paintings. Furthermore, they say it's part of their public trust if they feel that if they're legally entitled to keep the paintings, they have a public trust to keep them in the public domain. They're on display. Anyone can go. They're a highlight of the collection. Anyone can see Adam and Eve whenever they go to Pasadena and drop into the museum. some people think that it shouldn't be a legalistic thing, that if people who can prove that they owned art and the Nazis took it should be entitled to get it back. But the way we resolve these things is through the rule of law, and that's what's happening here.
Mike Boehm writes about art for the Los Angeles Times. Thank you so much for this.
You're welcome, Barbara.
I know this music. This is Feedback with Jolie Myers music.
Sometimes I play this just when I'm walking around my house.
You do.
Just, hey, it's Jolie time. That's actually not what I do, but now that I brought it up, yeah, I think so. Okay, so we talked about paid sick leave earlier on in the show. President Obama called for an expansion of paid leave last night during the State of the Union. Of course, we heard him talking about that. And so we asked all of you, should everyone have access to sick leave? A lot of people weighed in on our Facebook page like you do. Brian Smith says that sick people coming to work is bad for business. Bottom line, literally. Kendra Robinson told a personal story. She says she remembered a time when she was in college and worked at a bank vault with about 10 other people. She went into work despite being super sick, and her colleagues were ticked off. They, of course, didn't want to get sick. But Kendra says that there was no way that she could take an unpaid day off, let alone four or five. She was quite sick. She didn't want to be at work or get anybody else sick, but she didn't really have a choice. And I think that this is what this is about.
Well, that is what it's about. And if you're a part-time worker, and many, many more of us are part-time workers, mm-hmm, you don't get paid mm-hmm. sick leave, and you're getting everybody sick.
Right. So. And as our first person to weigh in says, it is bad for business. If you knock everybody out, then everybody's out. But Adam Heath says he's kind of torn on the issue. He thinks leave is important, but Adam is the business manager at a place where a lot of teenagers and college kids are employed, and they call off all the time because they partied a little too hard the night before. Do they deserve paid sick time too? He just doesn't know.
Well, there might be a little generational bias going on there, though.
Maybe.
Do you think? I don't know. It's such our Protestant work ethic. I thought that would come up in our conversation.
Right.
And I really love it when all of you write in and also call in. We love to play your thoughts on the air. Call us at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. And with that note, goodbye. Thank you so much. That's it for today. Take care.